The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
So thank you for joining us today. So Ty and I have gotten to know each other over about the last 4 or 5 years, but we've never officially presented together. So, and we briefly went over this presentation at a little diner about 2 weeks ago in Pennsylvania. So please don't hold the synchronization or the lack thereof of synchronization against us. So just by a show of hands, how many of us have at your school embarked on a capital campaign before and enlisted the help of an outside consultant like myself to do a feasibility study, just by a show of hands? Okay. So those of you who were at ACCS last year will remember that David Goodwin was standing before all of us at some point or another, and he talked about the growth that we aspire to see in the classical Christian school movement. And as I was listening to those remarks, and as I continue to contemplate them, as passionate as I am about the movement that we're all a part of, I know it's very important that we all learn how to raise money. And so I have found a little bit of a niche as a part of the Better Schools team, helping your schools raise money. So the way we're going to do this today is I really just want to leave you with three questions that you folks actually can use yourself. You don't need to pay our firm to come in and ask your constituents these three particular questions. After I sort of introduce these questions, I'm going to ask that Ty come up and share with all of us his experience, both his personal and professional experience as the head of school at Veritas, as well as some thoughts about his board's experience. Veritas enlisted our firm to come in and do one of these studies on their behalf last spring, last fall. Right, sometime shortly after this conference last year. And so Harvard University, about 15-20 years ago, Harvard University was on the cover of Newsweek magazine. The president of Harvard University was on the cover of Newsweek magazine, and right under the heading on the cover of Newsweek was the word exhausted. The president at the time, Harvard was embarking on the largest capital campaign in Ivy League history. It was something like a $2 billion goal. And the gentleman had to essentially disappear. Rumored that he had an emotional breakdown. And this was a capital campaign, and this is at Harvard University of all places. And I get that, and I'm sure those of you who have embarked on similar projects, certainly on a smaller scale, but the complexity that is involved in a capital campaign is actually quite overwhelming. And so that's sort of that sensitivity that we bring. So there's three questions I want you to, it's in your outline. There's three questions I want you to consider that are certainly the questions that we help our clients answer in a feasibility study. This first question is the most obvious question. It's the question that all of you want to know, and it's the question that usually is usually the question that sort of ignites the opportunity. And that question is: does your constituency have the capacity, and more specifically, the financial capacity to respond at levels consistent with your vision? That's the easy question, actually. That's actually not a particularly difficult question. Getting in there and interviewing and interacting with your constituents, looking at your giving trends, that's actually not the question that's all that tough to answer. And yet that's usually what folks like yourselves, you sitting on sort of your side of the table in negotiations with a fellow like me, that's the question you want to have answered. Look, we want to do this. We want to build this. We want to go there. We want to be able to provide this, and we want you to help us determine whether we can do it and how people are willing to pay for it. But there's actually two more important questions, and our firm is actually finding that these two second questions, question number two and question number three, are actually very valuable questions for you folks to be answering or asking of your constituents quite regularly. This second question, the answer to this question, usually hurts a little. And that question is, assuming that you have the financial capacity, does your constituency share your commitment, second C, to the vision being proposed? This is the question we're asking here is, do they love you? Do they love you? And oftentimes in fundraising, and oftentimes as you're sitting around the board and you're talking about the possibility of this grand vision, we make an assumption that people love us. And we make the assumption that they love us so much that they'll write us these really big checks. But oftentimes in a feasibility study, we find out that they love other things too. That they simply have other priorities. And they are very capable. The answer to the first question is there. Yes, they have the resources with which they could write you a very large check. But right now, their heart's in a different place, and that's okay. And we have to be okay with that, and that's what we need to help you answer. So that one stings a little bit. The answer to that question sometimes stings a little bit. But if the answer to the second question stings a little bit, the third question stings a lot. Stings a lot. Assuming you have the capacity, so assuming you have the individuals in your school community who are capable of writing you very significant pledge cards or commitments, and assuming that they are similarly as committed to the vision that you have, is your constituency confident in your ability to carry out the plans that coincide with the campaign goal? And to find out that they don't hurts. To find out that they don't trust your strategic plan, to find out that they're not confident in you as the head of school or one of the chief administrators, to find out that they question the judgment of the board, to find out anything that reduces their confidence level, which ultimately is probably the most significant influencer of whether or not they're going to write you that very sizable check, is very difficult. And those are the three questions. Those are the three questions. We call it the 3C analysis. And those are the types of questions that I would encourage you, if you're sitting down regularly with major donors, with individuals in your school community who are generous to you, I would encourage you to either use these very questions or craft very similar questions. So we started having these questions. We started having these conversations with about 50 of Ty's constituents last summer. And so what I'm going to ask him to do is just come up and sort of share what that experience was like.
Thank you, Jason. My name's Ty Fisher. I'm the headmaster of Veritas Academy. I've been the headmaster of Veritas Academy. In July 1st, I'll be starting my 20th year at the school. I'm the chairman of the Board of Governors of the Association of Classical and Christian Schools, and my story starts with an opportunity. Veritas is located in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, only slightly more beautiful than York County, Pennsylvania, where Jason is from. We had an opportunity because there was a facility, an old public school building facility, that looked like it might be available for us. Now, we had never had a capital campaign at our school. We've grown pretty slowly over the last 20 years, that looked like an opportunity. But since we'd never done it before, we kind of lacked confidence in what we're even supposed to do with a capital campaign. So And we were in the process. We were in the process of kind of looking at that opportunity, and then what's even better, another opportunity became available. So, you know, with real estate, they always talk about location, location, location. So a property became available that if I could have any property in Lancaster, it would be somewhere near this property. So we said, we knew it would be substantially more expensive than what we were thinking about. So like that gulp moment kind of happens, right? Can we do this? And as we started to think about doing it, we found that very quickly we had to fall back on what we would call gut feel. Now, many of you, like I run some things in my life off of gut feel, but running a big capital campaign off of gut feel was just terrifying, honestly. So we said, we've got to get some help. And after a few abortive attempts, we went out looking for Jason to do a feasibility study on a particular property in Lancaster. So Jason met with our donors. I would say this, that I'm saying this not just about Jason, but he said these are questions that you should be asking your constituents, and that's good and right. I would say for us, as we hit that place where we're thinking about an $11 million capital campaign, it was imperative that we had somebody from outside of just us asking our donors that question. Because what we found out really quickly after Jason was asking questions is there were things that they were able to be open about with Jason that they probably couldn't have been open about with our board members, and especially with me. Me? Come on. Like, I've been there for 20 years, right? You should feel comfortable talking to me. But, well, I'll tell you more about that. So when after Jason was done with these meetings with our donors, we all got back together, and he kind of made the presentation to our board. And he walked through these three questions. And the first one on capacity, we're not a large school, a little bit over 200 students at the time. And so I was worried about the capacity question. And he came back and said, even though you have a fairly small community here, there's some substantial wealth within the community. So there's that capacity question. Check. So then we get down to that second question, the one that he said would sting a little bit. You know, the one about commitment. And as he kind of talked with our major donors at our school, what he found out was that not only did they have the financial capacity, but that as a constituent group, they were committed to our school. So even though there were things that he found out about that commitment that showed us maybe they don't understand everything about Veritas Academy, go figure. Or that there are some things about Veritas Academy that really irk them. Again, go figure. So, but that hurdle was one that, you know, as he interacted with these donors, we felt like we could clear. So, boy, now it kind of builds up the tension, doesn't it? Because there's only one question left. And that was the question that came back, the question of confidence. And what we found out was our donors did not believe in the plan that we had and did not believe that we as leaders at our school could accomplish that plan. Okay, now that was really bad. I cannot convey, I'm not emotionally open enough to convey to you here in this setting how painful that was. Because it wasn't just painful on the, like, no, right? Just say, like, no. Jason would have just walked in and said, yes, yes, no, and left. much less painful and not very helpful either. But he gave us the gory details of why they lacked confidence. Now, lo and behold, note, we've never accomplished anything like this before. And I don't know what your school is like, but if your school's like my school, we haven't really even thought about, we haven't thought enough about having board members that would have this kind of wisdom that would convey that level of confidence to our donors. We also didn't hire a headmaster 19 years ago that I was able to manage the finances of our school incredibly well 19 years ago. I could carry them in my pocket, right? So, again, you know, when you're getting feedback like not really confident that isn't Ty the isn't he an academic guy? Like he's reading Aristotle back in his office again, you know? And it was at that point, we learned that we were not ready for this capital campaign. And so that's kind of the bad news, right? Although let me just say this. Learning that you're not ready for a capital campaign before you have a capital campaign is not the worst case scenario. And that's actually why I felt really strongly about having this workshop, even though it's requiring me to be more emotionally vulnerable than I'm comfortable with. It's because a lot of your schools are in that same place. You're at this point where you might have to go with like a gut feel jump off. And I thought this process was immensely helpful to learn that we had some significant work to do if we really wanted to accomplish what we needed to accomplish. So that's the bad news part of it. Okay. The good news is this, that even an answer of no on a feasibility study like this is actually not an answer. It's not a no and then you kind of sit there and you have nothing to do. You could do feel like that for about 2 days. But then after that, it gives you a pretty clear idea of what you, as a board and as a head of school, need to work on accomplishing in order to actually get to where you want to get to, which is still that same property, which still hasn't been purchased at this point. What's that mean? So what we had to sit back and say, what would make our donors confident? Well, one of the things we looked at was our enrollment. Our enrollment had been pretty flat for about 5 years. They asked this terrible question, which was, so you guys want a new big facility. Why do you need that? Don't you fit in the nice little cozy facility that you have right now? Why do you need that? If you want, so what we needed to say was, if we want these people with the capacity and commitment to support what we want to do, we've got to prove to them that we need a facility. We need to burst at the seams, basically. Okay, if we're going to do that, they need to have confidence that we have the horsepower in the development office, not just academic folks that are really going to lead that charge and push our organization forward. The good news for us is it gave us a great impetus for forming a strategic plan that would push toward getting people to be confident about our school. So we put a lot of emphasis on enrollment growth. Ralph Cochran's here. We hired him to do some marketing for us through Scola. And right now we're like I said, a school of 200 then. We're about 35 students ahead of last year, so that would be significant growth. We don't have much room in our facility. It's going to feel almost bursting next year. So, and we're going to let everybody know that, boy, it feels tight in here, a little constricting. As a second thing, we're really working on trying to say, what does our development department really need to look like if we're going to actually raise money and get ready for a capital campaign, which we want to have at the end of, we want to be ready for that at the end of this five-year period. We want to go back and do a feasibility study again, and we want it to be yes, yes, yes. So that's why I would say listen to Jason. Listen to Jason, what he's going to tell you about the feasibility study. I would also say this. I'll put in a little plug for Jason here on a personal level, and that is he has no conscience. He has no conscience. He tells you painful things all the time. He always says painful things to me. So, but listen, if you're the head of a school or you're a board member who's a successful businessman, you need stuff like that is good. No one tells me painful things after 19 years. I need people. You need people around you like that that will say, guys are just blowing it here. Okay, you've got to get the ship pointed in the right direction. So I'm going to welcome Jason back up here, and he's going to tell you more about the process of the feasibility study.
Thank you, Todd. I'm very sincere, though. I am very honest. But I think that's what God, as I was sharing with Leslie and Dave last night at dinner, I think that's what God is doing in my life, is to be sort of that, sometimes that bearer of bad news. And I'm not supposed to be in your seats, but I'm supposed to walk alongside you in some of these tough journeys in order to grow these schools. And Ty sort of alluded to what Chuck and I are starting to realize for our clients, the value of the study that we did for Ty and his board is actually now enabling them to have a much more informed strategic planning process. And so in our recommendations to some of our clients who are considering and make sure you follow me here, the logic here, if you're looking at a strategic plan and you're assuming that something on the back end of that strategic plan is going to have to be fundable, right? So if there's a, you know, if there's something that's going to have to be, you know, millions of dollars is presumably going to be written into that strategic plan, it may not hurt, as what we're finding with high school, it may not hurt that you approach the feasibility study in advance of the strategic planning process so as to inform your strategic plan. I'm working with a client in Wisconsin right now. Through their strategic planning process, and it's very evident that they have lacked a level of engagement with their donors, which is some of the same stuff we talked about with Ty. And so their strategic plan is being informed by one of those categories in their plan is going to say, hey, we're going to start taking people out to lunch and having meaningful conversations with our constituents. So let me just break down very quickly to sort of stay on track here with my outline. The part of a feasibility study is not just to talk to your people about the types of checks they're willing or not willing to write, but it's also an internal assessment. So it's also kind of looking at you and your team or your lack thereof and saying, are you really ready for this? And I go back to the Harvard example. The gentleman and his team were totally exhausted. We're working with a client in Los Angeles right now. A capital campaign of the magnitude that some of you may be dreaming about is essentially adding a whole nother division. I mean, it's the necessity to expand capacity in a way that your organization has never had to deal with. And it can't be staffed by one single individual. Very likely your development director, those of you who are fortunate to have one, probably doesn't have the skill set to navigate the complexity with which would be required of a capital campaign. So the value of a feasibility study is also to answer the question, are we ready for our first campaign? The other point there that I have, 1B, is do you have an inexperienced team? So do you have individuals on your team who know what they're doing? And then what we're encountering most often, because of the nature of the way that we private schools, and this is big private schools, I mean K-12 private schools, don't necessarily have to be classical Christian schools, but we tend to have a very disengaged constituency. And the reason we have a disengaged constituency is because we like to do things like galas and golf tournaments, and so we're doing these annual fun sort of things, and then we want to immediately jump to capital campaigns. Well, if you are familiar with what they do in higher ed and big medicine and the way they raise money in those big institutions, is there's a whole layer of fundraising and cultivation with those donors that's happening right in between that. So you don't jump from galas and golf tournaments to capital campaigns. You take people out to lunch, you listen to them, you learn what their passion and interests are. And you have to have a model, which most private Christian schools and K through 12 independent schools don't generally have. We're very heavy in the what I call the top lane or lane one, and we like to get to lane three, but we are very absent when it comes to lane two. And all of you folks may assume that you're doing everything you're supposed to do because you see the galas and golf tournaments, you see the local university doing the galas and the golf tournaments, and you see the capital campaigns because they're building buildings. But that middle lane is what we call major gift fundraising, and that happens at the lunch table, and you don't generally see that. And so it's not something that you generally observe, you as the onlooker of what the bigger shops are doing. So what are the consistent findings that we find, and by we I mean people who have long done this longer than I have, what are the findings that we generally find in K through 12 private schools that folks like yourselves may not be thinking about at this particular point in the capital campaign adventure? The first thing we call it the grandparent factor. And what we mean by the grandparent factor is generally it's just those that are 55 to 60 years or older. And what more specifically, those who think in terms of financial plans or financially, we're talking about basically people who are more asset-based givers rather than income-based givers. And most of your families, your parents, are their contribution, their pledge to your campaign is going to be income-driven. So even if they're making a very sizable commitment to the campaign, it's still going to be more in line with what their income is. We generally do not plan, in a feasibility study, we generally do not test out and assume that your parent population, your current parent population, is going to account for more than maybe 35% of the goal. The other thing that oftentimes those of you who are considering a capital campaign do not consider is that capital campaigns are pledge-driven. They are not cash projects. And if you want to know the first sure way to undermine your capital campaign, it's to believe that you can do a cash-driven capital campaign. Capital campaigns generally have what's called a 7 to 12-year spread. 7 to 12 years. And so capital campaigns are dependent upon multi-year pledges and dependent upon short-term financing. So when I come into your school and do a feasibility study with you, I'm going to want to interact with you and your banking institutions to find out if you have a banking partner who's willing to bridge what we call the 7 to 12-year spread. So what is that 7 to 12-year spread? So you have two years of basically pre-planning, doing the feasibility study, securing your lead gifts, securing what you generally hear the quiet phase. It basically generally consists of about 2 years. Then you solicit for a period of 5 years. You solicit 5-year pledges, right? So there's your 7 years. But if you have a gift that you solicit in that fifth year and it is paid with, you know, over 5 years, you have a 12-year spread there. You have a 12-year spread. So when you folks are thinking about the possibility of a capital campaign, or you're admiring, which is tends to be the case, you're admiring what some other institution in town is doing, and you hear these remarkable numbers, please don't assume that they're raising that first and foremost in cash, and please don't assume that all that money's coming in a matter of 2 years. Okay? So when somebody says, we've just raised $5 or $10 million, that money could be coming in literally over a decade of time. It is very likely. It is very likely it'll come in over a decade. Case in point, my client in Harrisburg right now, a $2 million lead gift, he had to liquidate non-cash assets in order to make that first $400,000 payment towards the pledge. It took 6 months just to get to that initial. So just getting some of those initial cash flows are what require the bank financing. And a sure way to figure that out when you're talking to your bank is just simply have you enter, you know, if I'm talking to a bank and they tell me they worked on somebody else's campaign, it's a good sign. But there's a lot of banking institutions that have not worked with capital campaigns. And generally, it's kind of a they either have or they haven't. And so they understand what's going on. The other thing that we find in K through 12 private schools, especially Christian schools, is we're teaching young people, young parents, to possibly make, we're teaching them, they're learning how to give for to make in terms of first-time commitments. So the families that you're soliciting during a capital campaign are most likely making some of the most sizable contributions to an organization that they're very confident and committed in for the first time in their life. So you're essentially training them up. And that's that pastoral sort of discipleship sort of posture that you have to be willing to take. You have to So I've got a father in Los Angeles right now. We're working on with one of our classical schools. It's a $10 million campaign. He's 42 years old. It is driving him bonkers to think about the possibility of making a $1 million pledge. He can absolutely do it. And he's made $1 million investments in other things in his own, you know, in his business, sort of private, whatever you want to call it, world, in that paradigm. But to think that he could actually commit, say, $200,000 to $250,000 a year for 4 to 5 years, and all the contingencies and what's going on in his brain, like, wow, can I really do that? He absolutely can do that. But our role as the counsel and certainly our client, we're having to sort of walk him through that journey. And you folks need to be aware that that's happening. So we have about, I think, 10, 15 minutes. I want to make sure, I'm just going to run through what these definitions are, again, of capacity, commitment, and confidence. And then I want to allow Ty to join me back up here, and we'll answer any questions if you have. Ty, one of the things that I'd like somebody to ask you is you talked a lot about your experience, but I think your board had some thoughts too. So just running through capacity again, we basically use two variables when we're testing capacity. We're looking at the size of your constituency, and we're looking at the wealth that we assume that constituency to have. And if you're in the fundraising world, there's all sorts of creative and sometimes particularly legitimate and sometimes completely illegitimate ways to do that. We could have dinner over that. The second question is commitment. And what we're looking to test there is we're looking at what is explicitly said in the interview or when we're interacting with them, and then we're actually looking at giving history. So I'm actually going to, so if I get into a meeting, and I'm interviewing one of your donors, and the donor says yes, and we love this organization, but then I go and I look at their track record of giving, and I find out that they're giving somewhere else in a very different way, I may sort of score down, if you will, what that commitment level really is. And then this confidence question, we very pointedly ask, so what's your thoughts about Ty? What's your thoughts about the board? What's your thoughts about the strategic plan? And we generally, when we ask those questions, we kind of get sort of, there's a normal sort of line of answers. We oftentimes hear things like, we don't even know what the strategic plan is. That's a big red light for me, because you're going into a meeting asking people to make essentially personal, financial, very strategic on their part, you know, decisions, and yet they don't know what your strategic plan is. So that's what we're looking for. So Ty, you want to come back up here, and we'll, Ty, why don't you talk a little bit about the board reaction?
Yeah.
Because I remember it very well, going through the, about half of them thought one way and like half of them wanted to run me out of the room, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of them threw things at Jason. that actually didn't happen. But for our board, I think it caused a lot. And what I would say, Jason, is it's kind of an evolving response, too, because there are some people who were kind of one way that night who've kind of digested more, and you find them in another direction. But the getting the information was like the first part of the challenge. And the board members, when you're telling board members and school leaders that, you know, the main problem you have here is confidence, like the stingy part, you know, what do you do when a bee stings you? You want to swat the darn bee, right? So there was some of that reaction. What I've been really thankful for is from that point, you know, our board has, I think, really engaged more successfully. So we went from, I think, a board that was probably too involved in the details of schools, like, you know, just about every startup board, to a board that kind of probably stepped back a little bit too much, to now a board trying to figure out what are the things that only we can do. And right now we're going through what we call an organizational assessment. So they're kind of looking at everything that we, all the resources that we have, especially the personal resources that we have in our school administration, and saying, if we want to accomplish this strategic plan, what do we need to add? How do we need to change things? How do we need to relate differently to make all of this happen? So I'm really looking forward to how that helps to move our school along as well.
Does anybody got any questions? Yes, ma'am.
How did you choose to share your strategic plan with donors?
Yeah, I'd say what that was an interesting thing, because a couple of times today, a couple of speakers have said this about strategic plans. And this is, you know, let me help you. If you want to have a lack of confidence, do the following. Okay? So write a strategic plan faithfully every 5 years, and then look at it once or twice and shelve it, right? And then say to everybody, like, hey, here's our strategic plan. Yay, rah. So, but for us, it was kind of interesting because we were in the process of redoing our strategic plan as we were getting some of the feedback from Jason. So what it did for us was it helped us to kind of form that plan. The feedback that we were getting on the feasibility study helped us to form the strategic plan in a way that pulled things together. We were asking the question, because the big payoff at the end of this strategic plan, we hope, is to successfully run a capital campaign for a facility. So we're thinking, what are the things we need to do to have that payoff at the end of it? Okay? Yeah, actually, we've had some group meetings with the same people from the feasibility study and other major donors that Jason just wasn't providentially able to meet with, to kind of share that plan with them. But one of the things that I really need to do, your head of school, or, you know, whoever's running communication at your school, the head needs to make sure this happens, is that you're putting it back out there over and over again. So that they're not shocked or surprised when you get to year four of the 5-year strategic plan and you say, hey, remember that feasibility study? We're coming back again. We think that we're in a better place to move forward.
And Veritas has enlisted some help that the board trusted to get that done, because part of what we discussed. And I know some of your key board members sort of got this, was that if they don't have the confidence in you as you the head or you the board, more than likely they may not have any more confidence in your ability to write that strategic plan successfully. And so you guys have continued to enlist not only Better Schools but other local groups to help them navigate that process, because they're trying to, again, you're trying to raise that credibility with some key stakeholders who can help you move those things forward.
One of the board members that we brought in was actually, he writes strategic plans for law firms. That's his job.
Yeah.
So we have we brought on a board member who was, and I had to argue with him a lot to get him, like, he was like, I'm not really sure I'm the right fit. I'm not really sure that, and like, we need you. We need you. So I had to, like, go to breakfast a bunch of times just pleading, come on the board. And he did, and he helped us to write a better strategic plan.
Yeah.
Now, you can still shelve a really good – the shelf is just that far away, right? But having him out in front of people saying, you know, this is what I do for – I do this for, you know, multi-million dollar law firms, and I was at the head of writing this for our school. Confidence. raises it a little bit. Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I hope that you can learn something from my experience to avoid some of it. But I would say this too, that we did a crazy thing, you know, but just between during this year is we bought a bus. Okay, so we actually raised money once for a 15 passenger van. Unfortunately, in Pennsylvania, we found out by the time we raised the money that 15 passenger vans are illegal. You can't. We'd use them for years, and they helped us. The state helped us understand that we would use them no more. So the bus that we wanted cost a lot more, but God kind of opened some doors. So it every little thing that you do successfully, and we got that bus painted in record time and got it down there at the end of year picnic and had everybody walk around the bus. You know, and it's not, I mean, it's not a Greyhound bus. So it's a little 24 seater. But it's wonderful. And it has Veritas Academy on the side. And if you're like me, don't fall into this trap. And it's the trap of thinking that the only thing important about classical Christian education is just the thing. Like the philosophy, what you do in the classroom, that kind of stuff. Parents love that stuff, but they actually want you to be an actual real institution. With like, you know, shorts that are the same color on your basketball team, you know, and like, you know, carpet in your classroom that's not 58 years old, and to do that, to have those kinds of things, you need to be disciplined about getting them the confidence to write that check, not just the tuition check, which our retention rate is very high, like 97% this year. So it's not that they're dissatisfied with the education they're getting, but we can grind them down by not being disciplined to become the kind of institution that they want to see that education happen in.
Yeah. Yes. We got two there. Yes, ma'am. Ladies first. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah. So, most of you have been convinced that you have to have all that stuff, and you don't. You really need to invest in talent. And you develop your own talent as fundraisers first and foremost. You need to wrestle with your own, you know, fear, and money is a big player in all this. You need to wrestle with the psychology of what's going on in all this. That's what a lot of my work is focused on. You need to identify your best 150 individuals. The Galen Golf Tournament sort of world, the fundraising world is really all about growing databases and big. And you, generally speaking, you're probably raising whatever amount of money that your organizations are raising. It's probably happening from less than 150 people, if not even a smaller fraction of that. If you're not taking care of those 150 people, ultimately a third of those people are going to drive 75% of your capital campaign. You know, it's very. So I'm working on a $10 million project right now in Los Angeles, Five people are going to probably drive the first third of that money. Another 20 might get us to 70, 75%. So if you're not on the pathway to identify who those 25 people are, you know, that's what we're talking about. But we tend to be very egalitarian and participation. You know, I'm sure a lot of you throw around the word, you know, 100% participation in your schools. That's completely undermining your fundraising efforts, because you really need to identify those individuals who want to be confident and want to be committed. And instead, you're chasing after marginal gifts. And they're either unwilling to give you those gifts, or they're willing to, or they're committed to other things. And we need to be okay with that. But that's that scale. You know, you don't need Razor's Edge. You start taking them out to lunch. So I'm doing, for this project in Milwaukee that I'm working on right now, we're on site once a month. The goal is 6 meetings a month, and we're just listening to their people and listening to the right people, and you know, people that we think that are most likely to 2 years out be at the place where Ty needs to be. And if you're not doing that because you're so overwhelmed with galas and golf tournaments, there was this gentleman then, and then you, Ralph. You're going to spend, in today's market, you're going to spend anywhere between 18 and maybe 42. You know, you're looking at, you're basically paying for a consultant's time. You know, 18, 15, something like that. If you use a local person, you might get it less than that. You can pay in higher ed. We're talking about $100,000, you know, projects here. Big giant consulting fees. We're not making that, but
I would say that there's we found that there's some value in the profit being from not our hometown. Like York was about far enough away. Mm-hmm. So that was really good. And I would say this, that I think when we first opened the present, that seemed like a big price tag. In light of kind of what we learned, it was a very small price tag. So,
yeah, you're basically, I mean, some of that cost is just basically to make sure that you don't mess up. I mean, you know, $18,000 is a much less cost than for you to attempt to, and that cost assumes about a $3 million campaign. Our fees, for example, at our firm are not justifiable for a campaign that's less than $3,000. And that's one of the things. So getting back to all of these different other questions that you ask about fundraising, you know, the amount of money that we're spending versus, you know, the return on investment, I guess you could say, it doesn't line up. And so you're not going to pay me to get involved if you're talking about $1.5 million.
Yeah, you said $3,000. I think
$3 million. $3 million. Yeah. I'm sorry.
But just think about this. Where would that confidence be if you crashed and burned on a capital campaign?
Sure.
And then finally that those people who God gave money to so they could write you really big checks, those folks expect you to do the kind of due diligence that shows that you're serious about actually raising the money. So having a feasibility study is something like an insurance, buying some insurance to make sure that you're not jumping off someplace that you can't land. Ralph?
Ralph.
Yeah. You can read any book, and you can go out and read a book on giving strategy and stuff. So you're talking about this, but what's in my head is just, you know, it's so important to recognize skill levels.
Sure.
And expertise. And I don't know, Ty, or you did one of your comments, it's how you dealt with deprogramming that new experiment. Because if anyone here is showing us $18,000 to $42,000, we're like, oh, let's do it ourselves.
Yeah.
We'll read a book, we'll go find Jason's book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like that's a major problem.
the pain of this process has helped in the deprogramming. Okay? So when somebody says, you know, Ty, he's smart. He's not that smart. Like, he's smart like book stuff smart, not like actually getting this kind of thing done smart. That hurts. That hurts. And then you say, like, it's obvious when I went out, because I kind of went out and talked to our donors about this and did not get the same information that Jason got. Okay? So then you go, like, golly, I'm flying blind. So that's why I would really, if you're looking at a big, serious, scary capital campaign, I would really encourage you to take a look at getting somebody who has some expertise and somebody that has some emotional distance from your leadership, because they're the least likely to get the kind of information that you really need.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Right. Well, I mean, those three questions kind of help you do that. Like, you need to look for capacity. You need to have lunches with people and start to nail down who those people are. You got to work hard to get people to love you and be committed to you. And then you got to take those little steps to make them confident. Say things, do them, and remind people that you did them.
So the same ideas obviously are not going to be.
Yeah.
Right,
but that $500,000, and then the next one is $2 million, and the next one is $5 million, and the next one is $10 million.
So let me answer your, so, because I think this will be helpful for everyone.
This is the last question.
Yeah. So a lot of your fundraising efforts, if you look at it, if you look at direct putting things in the mail, the stamp, the envelope, if you look at the special event, if you look at grant writing, if you look at golf tournaments, if you notice there's a common characteristic there, and it's what I call arm's length. It's basically keeping the relationship between you and the donor at arm's length. You're not sitting across the table listening to each other. And so what ends up happening is you don't get to listen to them, and so you worry about, you know, that they're getting, you know, donor fatigue. We throw that word. Or donors weary. Well, they're weary because you're holding them at arm's length, and you keep expecting that they're going to come back to your gala and write you bigger checks, or you keep sending them mail. You're worried about donor intent or mission drift. You know, are they going to persuade us to go off? Because you're not listening to them. And so at the point at which you make a commitment to identify your best, the people who are most committed, not necessarily your biggest, but your most committed and most confident, and you start taking them out to lunch, you'll start raising real money. Yeah. But that actually requires more of all of you than it requires on the check. You know, that's as much on the receiving end as much the giver. And we're very focused on the giver, and we want to understand givers and why do they give and tax benefits and stuff. But you've got to be willing to sit there and be vulnerable and listen and ask questions. And that's really tough. And so we'd rather just do galas and golf tournaments. I don't like galas and golf tournaments. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Ty. I think that was really good.